Edward Swenson came to the Park Valley with his parents in 1891 at the age of 8. They were one of the first families to settle in this little Norwegian community, a remote clearing surrounded by wilderness until potlatch logging came in the teens. Ed describes their first trip from Moscow to Park, building their homestead cabin in the first survey, the appearance of the valley and its first two settlers, experiences with neighbors and Indians, and the tribulations of building a road which would connect Park with the world outside. Norway, and decided to come to the United States?
The which?
Do you know why your parents decided to leave Norway and to come to here?
My father's older brother came before they did and found land in Minnesota, you know, and to the people back in Norway, 160 acres of land would be a big farm. And they heard they could get land on a homestead here, so they decided to go. They saved up enough money for the voyage, you know, and came, and his brother met them in New York, and they came on through. They lived 3 years in Wisconsin to get a start for homesteading, you know, and then moved into Minnesota and located there with his brother as a neighbor, so they worked together in building up, you know, and got started there. They lived there about 19 years, I believe it was, before they came to Idaho.
Did you know, ever hear about what the conditions were like in Norway? Was it pretty hard in Norway?
So far as I learned from the folks, it was not bad at all at that time. But of course, for a young man to get started there wasn't so easy because the land was all taken up pretty well, you know, and father wanted to be a farmer. That was what he learned there, so that's how they came then. And the ship that they came on was a sail ship, of course, and it was a maiden voyage for that ship. It had never been on the ocean before. And so they, when they got pretty well out on the ocean, they had run into a storm, and for 3 days, they had to tackle back and forth against to keep from going back, you know. And it was pretty rough. Father got seasick, but not so bad, but he got over it. And mother had the two children, you know, to take care of. And she said it didn't bother her so much. And
so then they went to Wisconsin for a few years, and then Minnesota for quite a while, but then they decided to leave Minnesota. Why did they decide to come to Idaho?
The storms were so bad there. They lost two crops of grain 2 years in succession, and that discouraged them pretty much. And they had heard about this Idaho country, you know, and they decided they wanted to come west. And my oldest brother went first. He went in the fall of 1890, I mean to say. And then we came in the spring of 91 and settled there together and built up again. So the folks had quite an experience in pioneering.
They did it more than once. Pardon? They did it more than once.
Well, you see, they came out there on the prairie in Minnesota, no town nearby, and they had to build up the best they could right in the wilderness. There had been an Indian war the year before they came there, but that was settled, so they were safe in that respect. And then no neighbors around close by, you know. And they started with oxen and wagon to get to town. And that took a long time, you know. Mother had to be alone there with the little children until he'd get back. So it wasn't so good.
How did they decide to come out here? What means did they use to get out?
We came on an emigrant train from, I think it was Wilmer, Minnesota, to Troy, Idaho. But in the meantime, there had been a slide of land into the onto the railroad track between Roy and Troy and Moscow, so we had to get up at Moscow and go by wagon from there on.
Do you remember what that trip was like from by wagon out to the
yes.
Park Country?
My oldest brother left Mantis there, you know, with team and wagon, and we go part ways. It took us 3 days from Moscow to Park, Idaho. Very bad roads, you know, and my brother and I walked much of the time, and the father walked most of the time. So what little baggage we had was on the wagon, and my mother and my sister would ride in the wagon. And we came to, there was a farmstead about a mile east from Jewel down there. That was a station there, railroad station. Stayed the first night. The second night we got out to Texas Ridge and stayed there. And it took us about a day from there to get over to Park. When we got down to the river, the horses had to ford the river. There was no bridge, you know, and the water was high. And they had a foot log there for us to walk across. And when they got across the river, they had to take the wagon apart and use just the hind part of the wagon to carry what few things they could load on there to get up the hill on the east side. And then the next day they came back to get the rest of the things. There wasn't much road there. So we walked all the way across the canyon till we got over the park. It was just about sunset when we came to my brother's place. There.
Where did you cross the canyon?
Pardon?
Where did you cross the canyon?
There was a farmstead named Buckaloo on the west banks of the canyon, and there was a road down from their place, so some of our things were left there. And there was a kind of a makeshift road. It wasn't graded much, so they had to lock the hind wheels, rough lock the hind wheels on the wagon to hold it back, you know. And they had chains along. They cut down a little fir tree and tied behind the wagon to help hold it back. And made it down the hill. I can remember that because I thought it was so odd to see that tree dragging behind the wagon, you know? Yeah.
Oh, about where would that be today?
From Derry, it would be just about 4 miles south and then east. We didn't go by Derry at those times, you know. There was a road further south we got across on.
Well, why did they go so far? Why did your father decide to go all the way to Park?
Because my oldest brother was there, and two of his wife's brothers were there at Park. And they had formed a, they had land connected together, you know. And of course we wanted to be with them. So they went across there, and it just some ice. The valley laid there, some ice, timber scattered over, and not much underbrush, you know. And it looked so nice that they wanted to be there. And that was why later on, when they formed a post office there, they named it Park.
Could you expand on what that country looked like when you first saw it, what it looked like to you?
Well, from the first to beginning, where there was nothing, there wasn't even any fences or anything, you know. The land wasn't surveyed yet. Each settled where he thought there might be a dividing line, and then eventually they got a survey, ran across from a section line on Texas Ridge straight through the valley, and that was staked out, and then the farmers would measure out from that section line north and south and get pretty well located until it was surveyed permanently. I can remember Father was with the surveyor, and when they came to a section corner, they were running a line east and west. When they came to a section corner, that was not far from where we had, Father had built a house. So Father asked the surveyor to view out the line north and south through what would be his west line. And there had been timber burnt down, and there was a big pine stump by itself. And that happened to be right on the line, on the west line of our place. So the surveyor told him, that'll be your landmark for your west line. Then he measured up from this section corner to get the south line. And then he started from there. So, but some of the farmers there would be kind of off. They would be too close to the neighbor when they finally got their lines run, so they would move back then into a better location. My father had, they built a log house, and he had the logs built up pretty well the height they wanted. And when they measured up, well, we were about 5 or 10 yards in on our neighbor's place. So they had to tear the logs down and move them. But that didn't take long, because they marked each log for each side, you know. And as they moved them up to the permanent side, the logs would be laid on the side where they had been before, and just roll them back up again.
He didn't have the roof on the place when, by the time he realized it, he had to move it.
The roof wasn't on yet when they had to move it. So it didn't take long to move the walls, you know. And the foundation was just a log. They smoothed the ground out and started with a log on the bottom and up, and then they notched in the floor joists about a log high off of the ground, so the floor would be up from the ground a ways. I can remember when they built that, I wasn't able to do any work, but I was always with Father, you know, when he was working there. Mother was staying with my oldest brother, mother and my sister. But wherever the men went, I was right with them there.
Did it take them very long to build?
No. several neighbors get together, you know, and it wouldn't take long, and they knew how to fit the logs together, and it didn't take long. They cut down green trees and peeled the logs and notched them together. And they found cedar. Their cedar was the best to split for shakes, you know, for the roof. And so they split shakes and put on for the roof. And it didn't cost very much to build those days, except a lot of hard work.
Did you tell me that your father found a man that really knew how to use the broad axe to do
it? Yes. Yes, that was a neighbor. He had come in there just after we did. So we lived in the old cabin, you know, for I think about 8 years. And so father made a deal with this man to hew the logs for the what we call the new house, you know.
Oh, I see.
And there was no money exchange. This man needed a lot of fence rails to fence his land in, and we had cedar there to make rails from, and so father made a deal with him to pay him with fence rails. The man wanted $20 to hew the logs for the house. And fence rails was valued at a cent each then, 12 feet long. So father made 2,000 rails in payment for hewing the logs. And by that time we had horses and wagon, and so we delivered the fence rails over to the man's place for. And he stayed with us, he had room and board with us while he hewed the logs.
Well, getting back to the old cabin that you built, getting back to the old cabin, first one, was that the first thing that your family did when they got there, was build?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he located a spring of water not very far from the house, and then he got ready to build. And you see, we came in the spring of the year, and before fall we were in our own home there. And then he built a barn and chicken house and things like that. So he had to stay home and work all that summer. Then the next year, when harvest time came, he went out and worked in the harvest fields through the harvest and then back, and they would work on the farm through winter, falling trees and clearing land, you know, and to get broke up next summer. So there wasn't much idle time in those days.
Where did he go to work in the harvest?
Out in what's called the Genesee Valley. It's a farmland lived where there were about 7 miles north and east from Genesee where he worked. And they raised mostly wheat there, and they used binders to cut it with, and then they stacked it. Then when all the district was stacked, then they'd start threshing. So he worked until they got through stacking. He was good at stacking grain, and he worked through that.
So he'd just go out for the harvest season, and then he came back right away.
Yes, he'd come back then so they could they'd put up hay. There was the wild grass grew tall there. There was no cattle much around, you know, then, just a cow or two for milk. There was not any young cattle running there then, so the grass grew up good, and he was pretty good with a hand scythe, and he'd go out and cut the grass, and we boys raked it up into little bunches, you know, and shocked it up and then hauled it home. There was so much open land, so you'd go most anywhere and cut the hay, you know. There wasn't much brush or other small trees, so it was really nice there. You cut grass among those big pine trees, you know, out around. We had only one cow the first winter. Then the next year we had more. But it took a few years before he got enough ground broke up, you know, to raise any hay. So we had that grass. And I remember one winter we were short of hay for the cows, and the cows liked the moss that grew on the pine trees, and they were cutting down trees to clear the land anyway, so the cows would come and eat the moss off of the branches, and then he fed him hay at night. So we made through.
This land being so clear of brush, is that because the Indians kept it burnt?
Well, there were stories about that the Indians would set fires when they were coming back out of the woods, but there were also fires from lightning, thunderstorms, which we knew happened after we came there. We could see trees on fire once in a while after a rainstorm, and of course that would set the grass on fire, so we kind of believed that was pretty much what did that. It was claimed that the Indians didn't want the brush to grow because it was easier for them to ride through, but they formed trails, you know, when they went back into the mountains. They had one trail up from Kendrick and up through, and that trail came through our land, almost through the center of it, right close to where we had built our house. They came through there, and going back into the woods to hunt and fish and pick berries. And they had a camping place right close to where Father built the barn. And one day they camped there, they staked their horses. We had broke up a few acres then and had seeded two oats for hay. But they stayed on the same camping place and staked their horses right in the oat field. The oats were out maybe 5 or 6 inches high. And they settled down to eat there. Father and the older boys were away that day, and so it was Mother and my sister and I. And so Mother told me, she said, "You better go and tell them to move their horses off of the oats." Well, I had heard the Indians were wild, you know, and I was pretty well scared of it, but I managed to get over there and showed them where they should stake their horses, you know. And they did. They started to move, put their horses over, and I ran back to the house. Then Mother told me, she said, "They were nice to you," so she said, "Ask them to come in and have their meal." Well, of course, I couldn't talk to them, but somehow or other I got the message across. So they came to the house. There was 5 or 6 of them. And Mother set the table out so they could eat, you know, at the table, but they put the table back where it was, and they sat down on the floor in a circle and had their dinner, and Mother had coffee for them, and and sugar and cream and things like that, you know, little fruit. And so they really enjoyed it, and they managed to try to talk, you know, to each other. But so then they went away, and in the fall when they came back, they stopped and to buy deer hides. You know, there was no season on deer. So when you were short of meat, you go out and shoot a deer. And my older brother, he had a gun that he could shoot deer with. And so we always had deer meat when we wanted it. And we'd heard about this, that the Indians would buy the hides, so we had deer hides on hand. They would pay 50 cents for a deer hide. But Mother thought that wasn't enough money, so she held out for 75 cents. And they, through motions and that way, they began to talk trade, you know, and she finally got the 75 cents.
Did they pay in money, or did they pay in trade?
Oh yeah, they had money with them. I don't know, you know, they used to make up moccasins and things like that and sell to the white people. So they'd have a little money. And of course, then afterwards we fenced the land in, so they had to follow the roads and back in.
How many families would you say were there when you got there?
I think there were about six families in there that next summer after we came. I couldn't say just what there was when we came, because I don't remember that. But as they came in, they began to get acquainted, you know, and visit back and forth. And I can remember there was about six right in the main part of the valley there. And they began to help each other, you know. As each new settler came, well, the others would go and help them get started and neighbor with them. We didn't have any schoolhouse the first year we were there. The second year, that would be in 1892, they built the schoolhouse by going together and getting logs and built up a log schoolhouse. So that fall we had a little school, but it wasn't until next spring that we really had a school term. But I can remember going to school after snow came in the fall. But then they waited till next spring then. So I was between 9 and 10 years old before I went to school. And I couldn't speak English. So the school was in English, of course. We lived in a Norwegian settlement back east, you know, back in Minnesota. And but it didn't take long. We had a very good teacher. I can remember the first teacher we had, a teacher named Ramsey. And he was very good with us children. He seemed like he was like one of us, you know. So we got along pretty good.
Were the other families Norwegian too, when you first got there?
Yes. I know four of them were. There was one family. They were supposed to be French Canadians. Their language was a little different. I mean, their English language was mixed a little with French words, you know. but they spoke pretty plain English anyway. And so they, but they didn't have children old enough to go to school until after they'd lived there a while. Their first child was born after they settled there. So they were among the smaller ones when I quit school there. I went to school until I was about 14 years old. By that time, the older boys were out on their own pretty much, you know, and I had to help father with the work, and so I had to quit school. We had our school terms in the spring then, you know, and summer. We had only 4 months of school at first, so it didn't take long. But we managed.
Was this teacher hired from the outside?
Yes, and they boarded with some of the settlers in there then, you know. I can remember towards the end of the years that I went to school, we had I think her name was Longfellow. And she boarded with a Norwegian family. She couldn't speak Norwegian, but they managed out. And she had to pay $45 a month for a board and room. And she was getting $60 a month for teaching.
She was getting $60 a month for teaching?
Yeah.
So she didn't have much left by the end of
no,
the month,
huh? But you know, a dollar was pretty big at those times, so. And wages were small. And she walked 3/4 of a mile to come to school.
What about this fellow that you mentioned to me before that you call the land grabber? This guy sounds like a real character in the early days.
Yeah, they had located there before we came. It was on his land that father first started his cabin. And when the survey was made, that section line came right by his house, just a few rods from the house, so he was lucky to be built so he didn't have to move. And so we had to move again. And the reason why he was kind of a loner was when he moved in there, he had a little money and he brought a carload of cattle and furniture and stuff, you know, horses, wagons. And so he was considered a little richer than the rest of them. And I guess it kind of went to his head because he sort of acted like he was better than the rest of them. And that didn't go very good because the others were good neighbors, exchanged work and all, but he didn't. So it kind of created a friction there, you know. And he, you know, in those times, law enforcement wasn't as strict as it was later on. A man could carry a gun any time he wanted to, and if he got crowded, he might be tempted to use it. So he began to get a little bit afraid of some of his neighbors there, so he strapped a gun on his hip and carried that around with him. And of course that didn't help any to be a neighbor, so. But eventually he began to see that he didn't gain anything by it, so he put his gun away and became a neighbor.
You told me that he got into a big argument about where the school should ought to be built.
Yes, they started building a school, and he thought it was too far from his place, and he began to object, and so there was another Norwegian joining him on the west of his land, and so he offered to give an acre of land to put the school over there. And the majority ruled on that. Well, he fought that, and he finally pulled his gun, but he didn't have time to use it. One of the men took the gun away from him and emptied the shots in the gun and stuck it in his own pocket. And so they went to work and moved the logs over to the other place and started building there. When they went home in the evening, he gave the gun back to this fella. After that, he didn't carry it when he came to work. Well, of course, there was a little fist fight included with him before they settled. He didn't stand in a show there, so.
Well, did they call him the land grabber because he tried to grab the good land?
Yes. Before the survey was made, he had run a temporary fence around over 200 acres of land there, you know. And so when the survey was made, why, he had to move his fences. And he had a boy, one of his, the oldest boy in that family, was the same age as I was. Well, at first, I kind of shied away from him, but we became good friends. We were in the same class in school, so we had no trouble at all. And eventually, they began to get more neighborly. This man's wife and my mother were good friends. They got to visiting each other and were real good friends. So the rest of us, like my sister and their girls, were good friends, you know. We began to neighbor back and forth, and things were pretty good. Mm-hmm.
Where, what part of Park did he stake out for his place? I take it he was close to the first person in there and had a chance to take the place that he wanted for his own.
Yeah, each one, when he came in, he just walked around there until he found where he'd like to be, and that's where they're located.
Where did he pick?
Pardon?
Where did this guy pick for his land?
He was right in the center of the valley. He was one of the first ones, and he located right in the center there, pretty well. And well, there were others just about as close in, but I mean, the first group, you know, that came in there would locate in the center, and he was one of them. There were two others, I know, that were right close in. The line came pretty close to the buildings of the first three settlers there, three or four, and he was one of them.
What was the, how would you describe the shape of the Park country, what it looks like and how big it is?
Well, the biggest part of the valley laid quite level. There were couple of little creeks of water running through during high water time and pretty well into summer, but in later years they dried up. So that was why, too, that they settled like that. They all wanted to be close to water, you know. And these little streams run through the land where they settled.
And it was, the timber was mostly yellow pine growing in the open and with grass?
Yes, on the flat there was mostly yellow pine. And there was fir thickets, young trees. fir likes to grow where there's moisture. So wherever the land would hold moisture long, that's where the fir trees would get started growing. So there was thickets of fir tree and then yellow pine scattered. They were not so, there wasn't so much trees there that what you could look down through the valley, you know, all over there. That's why it looked just like a park, like the trees had been planted there.
And then around the park area itself was forest, was woods?
Oh, yes. The valley was surrounded on three sides by mountains, and the timber would grow down onto the flats. Whenever the snow melted in the spring, a lot of that would seep down onto lower land, you know, so there was moisture for the timber to grow. But out on the main valley, the main level land, wouldn't be so much moisture, so the trees were more scattered.
Did you depend on the wild game a lot in those days?
Of course we did, because nobody had cattle to speak of. As they started settling there, they would bring a milk cow or two, and it took a while to have beef cattle. And so it was venison, and they had grouse and partridge. And then there were some meadows east from there, about 5 miles. And in high water in the spring, there would be salmon come up there. So the men would go back there with their spears and bring home a few salmon. So we had a variety. And of course, when they go out to town, if they had to have other meat, they'd bring home some from there. But very seldom they would have to buy meat at the market. There was no season on game. You could kill as many as you wanted. And the first summer that my older brother lived out there, he traded venison for meat at the meat market in Troy. He'd go out and shoot some deer and dress them up and take them to town.
Would you say that was the main part of your diet, would be the venison and other things that you shot in the wild in the first years? Or would you have a lot of store-bought food too?
No, venison was the main meat supply. In the spring they'd have salmon, and then of course they had partridge and grouse for a change. So there were bear scattered here and there before there were any dogs in the valley, where bears would be roaming around, but it seemed like people at that time didn't take to bear meat very much because they didn't eat it. But occasionally there was some that would kill a bear and use that meat.
Now for supplies in the early years when you were first there, where did you go and how did you get there?
Well, we had Kendrick on the southwest from us and Troy on the west side. There wasn't much road to either place, but the neighbors got together and talked over which would be the best route to take to town, and because they had to build a road, you know. So Troy was chosen as the best town. It was the biggest town then. Troy was built before Kendrick was. And so the farmers went together and they chose a couple men to represent the district to go to Troy to see what deal they could make with the merchants there, because they needed to have a supply of provisions to groceries to have while they were working on the road. They couldn't go out and earn money any other way then, you know. It took a lot of time and work to build that road, especially across the Potlatch Canyon. So the grocers in Troy agreed to furnish groceries and dynamite for blasting. So the men could spend their time working on that. And by that time, the settlement had grown, so there were, probably a dozen or more of good young men to work on the road. And they had horses and plows for plowing up wherever they could, but in the canyon they couldn't use much of that. They used the horses to kind of drag the trees away from where they were building the roads. They'd cut down trees, and there were trees laying down, and they'd cut off enough of the tree to have a space to drive through, you know. And they'd use the horses to drag those logs out of the way. The rest of it was handwork. There was a bachelor there that had done some mining, and he was familiar with using dynamite, so when they were running to Rockway, he would do the blasting. So they went on.
Well, where did the road go to connect up with the main road there?
It was a little further up the river, further north. There were some homesteaders on the west side named Morris, two brothers and their mother and father. And they had a road out to their place, you know, out on the breaks of the canyon, so the people at Park then continued on from that road and down across the canyon. There was no bridge there neither the first few years, but the main thing was to get the road. They could ford the river. So after they had the road built, then they built a bridge.
Was this road very switchbacky?
Yes, they had, on the west side was quite a flat, there was no what you might call creeks running down to cause any depression in the soil there, so they could go quite a ways. They made only three switchbacks on the west side to get up. But on the east side, there were 15 switchbacks. They followed the ridge pretty well on the east side to go up. And those switchbacks were switchbacks, okay. They were turned pretty short. When you got to dig into a steep side hill to make a turn, well, you don't dig very wide. But they made it. I know you couldn't drive four horses around those switchbacks. So they managed to get along anyway.
It was hand tools and muscle power, huh?
Yes. Pick and shovel and axe. on the crosscut saw. That was the equipment they had.
I imagine that it took him a real long time to put it in, too.
I can't remember how long it took because I was only about 9, 10 years old then, you know. So I don't remember that.
About where did it connect up with the road in Detroit?
Well, you know, the land settled up. As a rule, they start close to town to settle up, you know, and as they settled back, where they built roads through, and so that was, the road was built clear out to the breaks of the Potlatch Canyon. So then when we got connected up, we followed their roads on to Troy.
Well, before that time, where did the people trade before they put that road in?
Some went to Kendrick and some went to Troy. They had to go horseback and pack the goods in then, you know. And there was a post office located pretty well towards the first road they had in there. And they had a little grocery store there. So the men would go horseback across there and load the groceries on their saddle and pack it home that way and get the mail there until they got the other road built.
Was this Anderson?
Anderson was the name. That was the name of the people that homesteaded there.
Was there an actual trail there, or would it just be a cross-country?
Well, I suppose they cut a kind of a trail through, you know, so they could go through with a pack horse. The first two men that ever came to that valley were two miners. Big husky men. One was named Jurgensen, and the other one was named Goldstrom. Jurgensen was a Norwegian and Goldstrom was a Swede. And they walked across the canyon. They were prospecting. And they walked across the canyon and came in on that valley, and it looked so nice in there, they decided to settle there. So they staked out where they wanted to be. And then they went back to bring in supplies. They even carried their own cook stove in on their back, and other supplies that they needed, built a cabin and settled down. They were pretty close to the edge of the canyon there, where they settled.
Were they still there when your family came?
Yeah, they were there when we came. Of course, the stoves that they carried across were not the full-size cook stove. They were a little bit of things that they could carry, but they would do when there's just one man in each house, you know. They managed.
Would a guy have to lead his horse and pack the supplies on top of it?
Well, not when we came. They had that first road where we came through with the wagon, you know. So they would use that road until they built the other one.
And that road went fairly close to Anderson?
It was further north than Anderson, if I remember correctly. I'm not sure about this.
What about this other road? You told me that there was another one that wound up somehow getting built in a crazy location.
Yes, that was about 19 eight or nine. There was a little friction there about that. Some of the neighbors there wanted a certain route close to their place, you know, and the others wanted another route. So we got a surveyor to come in, and he was more friendly to the people on the what we call the East Road, East Route, that went north across the mountain and over towards Helmer after the Potlatch had built their road through. So they made a survey on that route. When this surveyor got to the top of the mountain, he began to look around and he saw there was no good place to go down without a lot of grading. So he stopped there and he went back to Moscow and reported in on that. Well, then it wasn't long till there was another route started, and he went back and surveyed a part of that, and it would have been a much better route. By that time, election came, and he didn't get elected for the next term. They got another man voted in, and he went in there, and he voted in favor of the East Route, and that was built. But it just wasn't used very long, because by that time the Potlatch Company built a road into Park for logging, built a railroad in for logging out their timber. And as soon as that was finished, when they pulled the rails out of there, while the settlers in there built that into a permanent road to market. And I believe that road is still being used.
Well, what you say sounds like it was just a very isolated piece of country in the early days. Isolated
between us and the market, yes. On that route, that was mostly just timber. And I remember we had to get permission from the Potlatch Lumber Company to build that road because they owned the timber through there. And they objected to having timber cut down just to build a road. So we made up a petition and took it over to Potlatch to get their signature. And I was appointed to take that over there. And William Deary, the head of had his office there. But that was the main office. There was another office that you came into first. I forget the name of that office or the manager of that office. But anyway, I presented my petition there, and he looked at it and he said that he would take it into the main office. He took it in there, and it was turned down immediately. Mr. Deere said he would have no road built across that on account of danger of fires being set by people traveling through. Well, I got a bright idea, so I told him I should think that road would be an advantage through there, because if any lightning fire or other fire should get started, they would have a road to get closer to their timber to fight the fire. So the petition went back into Mr. Deary's office, and he signed it with reservation. He said that they should not cut any timber that was not actually needed for the road and not build a right-of-way through there. And we agreed to that, so the road was built. No trouble.
He just turned it down and then he changed his mind and approved it on the spot, huh?
Yeah, did. And so then the survey was made permanent and the road was built. And they complied with that pretty well. They didn't cut trees that were not needed. See, the road was, as the road was surveyed, they just cut timber wide enough to form a roadway through. And the road was narrow so that if two trucks met, why they had to work their way carefully to get by, you know. But it answered the purpose until they got a better road.